You're listening to Amphibicast.
This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by Grey Ghost Creations. Specializing in unique wildlife art for lovers of reptiles, amphibians, and arachnids, Grey Ghost Creations offers a wide variety of art prints, stickers, pins, necklaces, and more. To find more unique original art, be sure to visit Grey Ghost Creations on Etsy at www.greyghostcreations.etsy.com. This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. This week, I have a great guest, a very interesting topic. We're going to discuss carnivorous plants. My guest this week is Drew Martinez. He's the owner of Carnivoro. And we're going to get into a deep dive. We're going to talk about carnivorous plants. Are they an appropriate choice for a terrarium? Some interesting topics. We're going to talk about some of Drew's wild observations of plants and frogs. We've got a whole big long list of stuff that I'm really eager to get into. I'd cover the topic very, very briefly in a few past episodes, and I'm really looking forward to this. I think it's going to be a really nice discussion, so we're going to get into it in a few minutes. But of course, before that, thank you to everybody as usual for the support. Five-star reviews, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, shows on Amazon, shows on pretty much all your favorite players. So if you want to take some time, leave a nice five-star review. Simplest way to support the show. Always appreciate that. And check out the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to the Patreon page if you want to become a patron and support the show for as low as $1 a month. I've got the most popular tier is the $5 a month tier. That'll get you a shout at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And follow the link for everything else. Merch store, link to In-Situ Ecosystems. You get a 10% discount off of a tank if you make your purchase at the link. And of course, you know, check out our sponsor this week, ExoTerra, and check out that link, or of course, visit your local dealer. And that pretty much covers it on my end. Of course, I like to get that stuff out of the way quick. But Drew, I'm really glad we finally got to talk. I know you and I had kind of gone back and forth almost like 6 months ago now. And we finally got an opportunity to get to talk to each other. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Doing great. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's been a busy 6 months, so it was a little hard to schedule, but really glad to be chatting now.
Yeah, I'm glad that we finally got a chance to meet. And I spent the past couple of days kind of looking over your website, and you'd sent me some papers a while back that I was just kind of checking out the abstracts. And I have so many questions, but before we get into kind of the meat of tonight's topic, I was wondering if you could introduce yourself to the listeners. Tell us about you. Tell us how you founded the business, the story behind it. And you mentioned to me off air that there's kind of interesting story behind the name. So if you could tell us all that, that would be a great way to start out tonight.
Oh, sure. Okay. So I don't know where I begin. I mean, I guess just kind of like a lot of your other guests, you know, I started off at a really young age being fascinated with beautiful wildlife. You know, I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. So, there was beauty around me. I didn't really appreciate it at the time because it was all arid, like desert plants and animals. I just had this appeal for the tropics. And, you know, I started doing frogs, geckos, snakes, you know, everything you could imagine, you know, at a, you know, probably 8 years old and beyond. We had a little zoo. My parents were really supportive of that. And then I actually saw my first carnivorous plants on a road trip to California. My aunt was stationed in Northern California, and my brother found this nursery, California Carnivores. And I went and visited the nursery owner at the time, and I was just blown away. You know, and ever since, I have been completely captivated by carnivorous plants. You know, there's just nothing in the world quite like it. I took that. Went back home, started cultivating my own carnivorous plants, still with the animals as well. But I always found it, I always enjoyed the challenge, involved with the cultivation, because I was growing up in a desert. So I had to really become adept at designing my own kind of mini environments where they could actually grow and thrive, because there's no carnivorous plants that are native to an area that's that arid. And, so I actually took that And I started studying up with some of my dad's old textbooks. He's an engineer, and I used some of his old thermodynamics textbooks to really get a good idea of how I might be able to design greenhouses in better ways. And that led me to get really fascinated by the technical, like, engineering side of things, and actually led me to study that in college. Actually, I studied both biology, and physics. You know, just because I was, and it was always with a focus on studying living systems. You know, how do we control environments to study living systems or to get living systems to thrive? You know, and so I bounced around a bunch in, like, the biotech field. Always, you know, like, it was always coming back to plants, though. You know, I always had a large collection of carnivorous plants. And then about 2009. It was actually that same trip that we're going to talk about in a little bit about the frog discovery. That's the first time I saw tropical pitcher plants, the Pentheus, in the wild. And at that point, I was just like, you know, I got to do something with this, you know, just more than just, you know, just keep them as a hobby. You know, I decided, well, these things are just so amazing, but their habitat is in just such peril. You know, maybe I could do something about this that can really, you know, really connect with people. And so the idea behind Carnivora was to inspire wonder and appreciation for nature by connecting people with the world's most amazing plants. And so it's been 15 years since I kind of started on this journey. And, you know, a lot of times I was kind of doing it as a sideline, but about 2016, that's when I decided to do it full time. We made the move to Austin. I've been doing that ever since.
So, I mean, the business aspect of it, because I have a lot of guests on here who have their own businesses. And I was just curious, was there one moment where you said to yourself, all right, this is where I want to make a change. This is where I want to be as a professional career from now on? Or was it a slow process? If you don't mind me asking, I kind of ask everybody how they, like, what the catalyst was to becoming a sole proprietor of your own business, because I have tremendous respect for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always, on one level, I always kind of knew I was going to do it. In fact, I was kind of a little, I was a little afraid of that for a little bit. Like, when I was in college, I recall being on a date one time and mentioning, like, yeah, you know, like, so I might do, you know, go through this career field that I'm trained for, or I might just go back and start a nursery, right? Like, kind of half joking. And then that ended up being what I was doing. But I mean, the inspiration to just, like, you know, really go that route came, I think, from visiting the plants in the wild and really discovering how deep it was, how deep my connection to the plants were. Now, not just, you know, this cool thing you can keep in your house, but, you know, like, there's a lot more to the environment that they grow into that really makes them unique and wonderful. And, you know, I really wanted to connect people with that. You know, the first step is to having some connection by having awareness of them. And then on top of that, you know, then people can really understand and learn a lot more about them.
What about the focusing on carnivorous plants as a, I guess, like, as a sole business model, as opposed to opening up a nursery with a greater variety? Like, is there like a huge carnivorous plant community? I mean, I'm totally ignorant of carnivorous plants. Like, is there, you know, a whole culture that's into them, or, like, what kind of role do they play in the general plant market? I guess we could say.
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely niche. And actually, we'll go back and say we do a lot of other plants too, right? Like, we do a lot of aeroids, other really cool tropicals, quartz flowers. Like, if it's anything weird and wonderful, we probably grow it in our greenhouses. Carnivorous plants has always been our focus, right? But carnivorous plants is definitely a niche, you know, in the greater even tropical plant hobby. You know, like, it's probably, I don't know, the industry is probably a bit bigger than the dart frog hobby. You know, in terms of number of people, but, you know, it's still a niche.
Yeah. And especially considering some of the species that you work with seem to be, I guess, is it fair to say, a little bit more advanced? I mean, I was looking at some of the pitcher plants, and I mean, we'll get into it in a little bit more detail, but, like, is there like a beginner, intermediate, advanced levels? Like, how does someone progress through the carnivorous plant hobby from say, beginner to expert, and how does that reflect in terms of which species that person would want to work with?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think there's great species in just about every genera of carnivorous plants that would be great for a beginner. You know, and so a lot of people, as they're getting into it, they'll kind of sample around. There's Nepenthes, there's Pinguicula, the butterworts, there's the sundews, the Drosera, and then there's Venus flytraps, you know, which just about everybody's had at some point. And all of them, I would say they're not particularly challenging to grow as long as you get a couple things right, you know, like, I can usually name it right away, you know, as soon as I look at a plant, it's like, I know exactly what's going on with it. You know, the two biggest things are most carnivorous plants are light lovers, and pure water. Most of them want RO, reverse osmosis, or distilled water, because they've evolved in these places that there's really low mineral content in the soils. And if you give them too much, like, you know, a lot of municipal tap water sources, you're going to burn the roots. There's a lot of things that are going to happen to them that are going to make them look really unattractive.
Yeah. How do carnivorous plants fare in terms of the environments? Meaning, like, I mean, from what I understand, again, my limited knowledge, you know, Venus flytraps, a very, very small region of the American, I think it's like the Southeast, right? Around Carolinas area, that somewhere there?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, from what I understand, that's pretty, pretty poor, and it's really not conducive to there's not rainforest growing there. But it looks like some of the tropical pitcher plant species tend to grow in areas that are very, very biodiverse. How does that kind of work out in the grand scheme of things? Like, is there, like, what environment is conducive to a carnivorous plant? Like, is there a universal? Does it vary by region? Or like, what makes a perfect spot for a carnivorous plant to succeed?
Yeah, I mean, this has been studied. There's some really technical ways to go about, you know, like determining likelihood of carnivorous plants. But I mean, there's a few things that I could tell you, that are going to be, you're going to likely find a carnivorous plant. Like, one is a lot of water, right? Because a lot of times whenever there is a lot of fresh water in an environment, it means a lot of nutrients are getting leached out of the soils there. So there's a good chance that, you might find some carnivores in that area. Also, another thing that a lot of these environments will have, because they're low in nutrients, they're not going to support a whole bunch of plants that have a lot of vertical growth. So because there's not a lot of trees in the area, there's a lot of light that's hitting the carnivorous plants. And so generally, I mean, it's almost universally true that carnivorous plants are light lovers. And that's just because most of the environments they grow don't really support that canopy.
Interesting. I see. Yeah, I mean, again, my limited experiences with them is we've got an arboretum here. There's a few arboretums where I live, and one is the Planting Fields Arboretum, and they have a greenhouse that is all tropical species. It's kind of like it's not specific to one region or whatnot. It's kind of like an all-species greenhouse, and I believe they have some of the Nepenthes in there, and they almost seem to grow like kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? Almost like the way bromeliads would grow. They have them high up, kind of fixed to other plants. How do they grow in the wild?
Oh, yeah. A lot of Nepenthes, at least, the tropical pitcher plants, mainly from Southeast Asia, they grow naturally as epiphytes. So, there's some species that grow on cliff faces instead of like tree branches. For the most part, they're growing, up in kind of a bit of leaf litter that's, you know, in a tree, or maybe they grow in an area that's at the top of a mountain that's, you know, kind of like a sphagnum bog that it's really exposed where they're getting a lot of light. Yeah, but they naturally, at least in the Nepenthes, it's kind of a lot of environments can be akin to like where you find bromeliads. You know, if they kind of get that action where it's a very wet climate, so you get constant rain, but then you also get a lot of drying out in between.
I see. Yeah, that was the word I meant to use, was epiphyte. I kind of embarrassed myself. I'm on your website and I'm looking, and I mean, these are absolutely beautiful. I was wondering if maybe what we could do is, I kind of wanted to ask you about, it was kind of a more basic question about some of the different types of carnivorous plants, but
sure.
You know, if you're okay with it, maybe can we do a rundown of, I mean, we could maybe start with Nepenthes, and then we could work our way through the American pitcher plants, Venus flytraps, the butterworts, and some other stuff. Why don't we start with Nepenthes? Maybe just give us kind of a background. What varieties are available, mm-hmm. care, begin, mm-hmm. Learning curve from beginner, just, give us a deep dive on Nepenthes. We'll start there.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah. Nepenthes, tropical pitcher plants mainly from Southeast Asia. There's a few species here and there that are from, Africa. But they generally are, tropical plants. They'll grow best in, kind of a loose aggregate soil, with mosses and things like that. Generally, temperature ranges, it can vary based on the species, kind of low end of like the 50s, like upper end, kind of like the 90s. But again, it depends on the species you're dealing with. They like more humid environments. They're tropical, right? But they can definitely be adapted to lower humidity environments. But for the most part, they grow in wetter places. In cultivation, they put out nice pitchers. They appreciate being fed. But they're one of the species that's a little more tolerant. If your water is not perfect, a lot of Nepenthes species you can get by on those. A lot of times you'll see them broken up into like different, the different climate zones that they're naturalized to. So it's like lowland Nepenthes, there's certain species that grow like sea level. And so they want it kind of hot and humid, like, what you'd envision like sea level in Borneo as. And then there's intermediate species. Those are the ones that like the really pleasant temperatures that humans do, kind of, maybe, 80 and sunny during the day, and it dropping to about 60 at night. And then some of the most diverse species with the most extreme adaptations are actually ones from high elevations. Those ones, generally live, at the top of mountains, and there's a lot of species diversity because they grow in these places that are really isolated from, like, say, the next mountain peak, maybe 100 kilometers away. And those ones, like I mentioned, they've got the extreme adaptations. So they're really toothy pitchers, they're really extreme toilet-shaped pitchers. You're going to find those more with the highland stuff. But the trick to those is they do like temperature drops at night. So, a lot of people will come in, like really gung-ho to grow some of the, some of the most iconic species there. And sometimes that might not be the best fit or beginner species. We've done a lot of work. I can talk about this later. We've done a lot of work breeding those to try to make them much more adaptable, just to an average household. So I guess moving on from Nepenthes, there's Pinguicula. That makes a really great houseplant, just based a lot on where they grow. So Pinguicula occur worldwide. Actually, they don't occur in Australia, but I think Australia, Antarctica, every other continent they grow on. And, there's Pinguicula that grow, in the Alps. There's Pinguicula that grow, in the Southeast U.S. But a lot of the ones that you find in cultivation are actually growing in Mexico. There's a lot of biodiversity for Pinguicula there. They tend to grow on limestone cliffs. And they actually go into a succulent phase in the winter, at least the Mexican varieties. And during that time, they want to be a little bit on the dry side. But they will flower year-round. And so one of the reasons why I always recommend them as great houseplants is because they produce these beautiful flowers. And it doesn't matter if it's summer or winter for them. They flower almost year-round. Whenever the summer comes on and it's the wet season, you water them a little bit more, and they do their thing. They put out their carnivorous leaves, you know, they start trapping things. And those are the one of the ones that actually get a lot of mosquitoes. Like a lot of people will be talking about carnivorous plants, like, oh, they're going to solve my mosquito problem. Most of the time, I can't tell them that that's actually going to materialize. But with butterworts, that actually does happen. You know, they'll get a lot of mosquitoes. They'll get a lot of gnats, you know, whitefly, those things that are in the house. And then another group, you know, is Drosera, sundews. And those ones also occur worldwide, everywhere except Antarctica. And there's just, sundews are just such a diverse genus of plants. It's kind of hard to go over all the different climates that they grow in, but generally they grow in pretty wet places with a lot of, where they want a lot of light. And let's see, you know, so there's some, you know, some of the really cool varieties. You'll find in Australia, they've got like these extreme adaptations where they actually die down to a tuber. They'll be in places that are really, really hot in the summer, really arid, and they'll die down to a tuber, and then they'll come back in the winter and grow rapidly and, you know, and catch prey with their sticky leaves. But, you know, some of the other, you know, varieties that are a little bit better adapted for growing as a houseplant, you just keep them wet year round, keep them in strong light. Like if you were like trying to grow them under a windowsill or on a windowsill, you'd want them in like right at the edge of the windowsill, like in like a east, west or south facing windowsill. Yeah, they, you know, they'll do their thing. You know, a happy sundew usually has pretty dewy leaves. And then let's see other groups of carnivorous plants. There's the Sarracenia. Those ones are the American pitcher plants. Those actually grow starting in East Texas, all the way east to Florida, and then all the way up the eastern seaboard into Canada. And those ones are actually, you know, you can grow those outside just about everywhere in the continental U.S. Those ones are also light lovers. One of the tricks is giving them pure water. But there's just a lot of really beautiful varieties there. They are very hardy. They, you know, we grow them outdoors in Austin year round. They have a lot of, tolerance to, you know, that really bright sun, really hot temperatures. Cause I mean, they grow in the South, and then even in the winter, you know, and during the winter, I'll let them get down to like 15 degrees and they're just rock solid. They're, that doesn't really affect them. And then, there's the Venus flytrap, you know, that, and you know, everybody knows that one. Those ones grow in the Carolinas. I mean, really the trick with flytraps is you just give them high quality water and light, and they're pretty robust plants usually. I think the reason why so many people are not successful with flytraps is you know, they come in these things that, you know, in the industry we call them death cubes, the ones you get at Lowe's or you know, like a garden center. It's a cool looking package, but a lot of those plants are kind of destined to perish. They've been put in the wrong type of soil, and they've been watered with salty water, and put on a truck for, you know, maybe up to a month. So the pine, they actually get around to being sold. You know, they're kind of on their way out anyway. So, you know, I think, you know, just about everybody's killed a fly trap, you know, and that's the predominant cause. It's just you weren't set up for success.
I have a few questions about that actually, because I know what you're talking about. I'd foolishly bought those a few times, and I knew, I was like, this is going to be a disaster. And sure enough, it was. But I was wondering if you could just tell us about the mechanisms that make these plants carnivorous, because I mean, the fly trap obviously has it closes and makes like little jaws, but the pitcher plants, the liquid that's in the pitcher plant, is that something that the plant generates, or is that rainwater, or how does that work?
Yeah, so it actually, so most Nepenthes produce their own digestive fluid, and they actually, they'll suck up water from the roots, and then they'll put their own enzymes and other you know, like methods to lower the pH of that water, you know, into the pitcher itself. And actually, most of them have a lid that's actually blocking the rainwater from coming in and diluting all that hard earned digestive fluid that the plant has created. So that's the vast majority of Nepenthes. There are some species that actually have alternate mechanisms. Like there's this one, Nepenthes ampullaria, that one actually allows the rain to come in, and it kind of it wants things to just kind of randomly fall in and get broken down by bacteria, not even necessarily its carnivorous enzymes. And so, like, there's been a lot of field research that have found that it actually has evolved to be a herbivore in some ways. You know, it's an omnivore, but like, you know, like, but what I mean is it actually has evolved to get quite a bit of its nutrition from the leaves that fall into the pitcher. That's Nepenthes in a nutshell. So the pH of an Nepenthes pitcher, just, you know, the average Nepenthes pitcher with the lid over it, it's about pH 2, which that's pretty acidic. You know, it's not going to hurt you, like if you were to put your finger in there for a little bit, but over time it does act, it's going to do its thing. It's going to definitely break things down. And it's actually activated by chitin sensors inside of the pitcher. That's what causes it to really start cranking out its enzymes and dropping that pH.
That's interesting. So they've really adapted to become aware of insect prey. That's wild.
Yeah.
With regards to feeding, I mean, I'm thinking, again, especially hot, humid, tropical Southeast Asia, I'm assuming there's insects around all the time. How does it not get overladen with dead? Can you overfeed them? Do they stop at a certain point once they've been sated? Like, how does that work? Because it just seems like such a passive way of, like, the fly traps. It's an active way. They catch something and they close it. But the pitcher plants seem to be so passive. How do they manage their needs in terms of the insect diet, and how do they not overdo it?
Yeah, they will overdo it. there's not really too much of a mechanism to get them to stop, other than the fact that at some point the parts of the pitcher that are functional, they get filled up. So, like, for example, a lot of Nepenthes have this thing called a waxy zone. That's kind of the upper part of the pitcher, where once an insect lands there, it's not going to be able to do anything but fall down deeper because it's waxy. You've got these overlaying crystals that make it super slippery in there. So eventually, if a pitcher fills up so much that it's getting above the waxy zone, then it's not going to be as functional. But usually what you find is if a plant is getting fed a lot, it's going to produce a lot of rapid growth. So it kind of, you know, maybe that those older pitchers might start to biologically senesce a little bit, but you're going to find that the plant is actually growing rapidly. In fact, there's a lot of mechanisms in the pitcher that have been studied that we found that whenever a plant is fed through the pitchers, it actually stimulates root growth, to really start taking off, so it can start pulling all the other things it needs, from the soil to activate a lot of new pitcher and leaf growth.
Interesting. And at what point in the plant's life cycle does that, when does the pitcher or the carnivorous part develop in the, you know, the life cycle of the whole plant?
Oh, yeah. Since they're small, actually, one of the first things it will do is it will produce these tiny little pitchers, you know, even when it's, you know, just a seedling. So most carnivorous plants are, immediately carnivorous. There are a few that are temporal, in the sense that only certain parts of their life cycle they're carnivorous. There's actually, let's see, there's two that I can think of that come to mind. There's actually one from where is it? It's like West Africa. I believe it's Sierra Leone. That one actually, it's called a triphyllum, and that produces carnivorous leaves like a sundew for only a certain part of its life cycle when it's young. And then after that, it just starts growing up, it's not carnivorous anymore. So it just needs that boost to start it out. And then there's actually, there's a carnivorous flower, believe it or not, only the flower of the plant. And that one was actually just a recent discovery, in the last 5 years. Those ones are actually native to the Pacific Northwest.
Wild. What's the biological process by which they convert animal prey into, how do they metabolize it? Because I mean, I'm just thinking photosynthesis and then being carnivorous, kind of, it kind of boggles my mind. How do they metabolize that animal? I mean, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. I mean, I was going to say caloric intake, but I'm thinking animal, not plant. How does that, explain that to me? How does that work?
Yeah, you know, actually, most plants do have the capability of uptaking nutrients through their leaves. It's called foliar feeding, and you know, that's generally, you know, plants can do that through you know, through various pores in their leaves. Carnivorous plants have just gotten really good at it. So, you know, they've got this active digestion, and then, you know, after that, they've got cells that have been adapted to do that even more efficiently, you know, to, you know, especially like, say, like near the bottom of the pitchers, those ones really suck up everything very quickly.
And how do they reproduce?
Well, I mean, so there is a big misnomer that the carnivorous parts are the flowers of the carnivorous plant. Now, there's one species, you know, that I mentioned that, you know, the flower is actually the carnivorous part of the plant, but that it by and large is not the case. You know, most carnivorous plants have separate flowers that are not carnivorous. You know, and those things generally they are attract a different pollinator than the prey they're trying to capture. You know, so they're able to still, you know, get pollinated without eating their pollinators.
That's a good point. I never even would have thought about that. I mean, you'd mentioned something before about mosquitoes. I remember reading some sort of an article about a mosquito species that was able to reproduce and survive in a pitcher plant, while every other insect that fell into there perished. I mean, is it safe to say that you really shouldn't rely on them for pest control?
I think that's safe to say. I mean, a lot of people will ask me, you know, like, is this going to take care of my mosquito problem or my wasp problem or something? And, you know, usually my answer is, well, these are plants that usually like to be wet. Whenever you've got a lot of water around, that usually attracts insects. So, you know, yes, they're going to be eating some, but at the same time, you're going to have, you know, more wasps hanging out and, you know, maybe more mosquitoes trying to breed or something like that. So generally I don't think they're a good, primary source of pest control.
Good point. You're right. You'd probably want an environment that would provide you with more insects than less, I guess, if you wanted to be successful. How do you manage that in a home environment? Because my frog room, obviously, I've got fruit flies and I've got spiders and things crawling around that are kind of a nuisance. I mean, in that way, it would benefit me. But for the average person who's not necessarily into bugs, how can that person satisfy the plant's need if it's being kept indoors in a house?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, I'll say this. Carnivorous plants are good at what they do. So if there's an odd fly that ends up in your house and you're growing a plant, you know, in the sunny windowsill, they're just naturally going to find each other. And the carnivores, they don't really need to eat that much to really derive a benefit. You know, like a fly a month is going to be plenty for most carnivorous plants. You know, it's really going to aid their growth. I mean, if you really don't like live bugs, you know, we actually use cricket powder for some of our more delicate species. We'll actually just buy cricket flour, you know, off the internet and sprinkle a little bit of that in. You know, this cricket flour stuff, it's supposed to be a substitute for flour. You know, and that stuff works really well. And if you really, really don't want to do that, there's actually a variety of fish foods that work really well to feed a lot of plants, or you could use just straight fertilizer. Some plants, you have to be careful on the dilution there, but, you know, for the most part, you know, a light bit of fertilizer can also serve the purpose of getting them to grow.
And what's the growth rate? Does it vary by species or variety? Is it universal across the board?
Yeah, no, that varies quite a bit across. You know, some plants, like I was talking about, like the Highland Nepenthes that are from these, you know, an 8,000 foot elevation, You know, that just naturally is a colder environment. There's less insect prey. Everything just moves slower there. So there's some Hylidopanthes. I've got this one, for example. I inherited it from somebody. He grew it a lot of his life, and then he was a great grower. But you know, he had a terminal illness, and he passed it on. And then I kept on growing it, and it's been I believe 35 years now. It still hasn't flowered. It still hasn't hit maturity. Yeah, it's just kind of this, you know, and I don't expect it to for probably a few more years yet. Whereas there's some other carnivorous plants, you know, especially the ones for beginners, they can hit full size within a matter of months when you're growing them. You know, they've got a growth rate similar to another plant. So there's by and large, there's no the hard and fast rule about growth rates. Generally, carnivores maybe a little bit slower, but with all the modern breeding and propagation techniques that are coming online right now. I think there's about on par with what you'd find, you know, with other varieties of plants.
So let's just say that you have a beginner, and I'll be the beginner for the sake of the example. Say, okay, so I want to get started off with, we'll just simplify it. We'll just say, I like pitcher plants. I'm not sure which species I want. I'd like to start off. I have a limited understanding. Which species would you recommend? What would I need to get started? Should I keep it in a tank? Could I keep it in, say, like an ExoTerra tank, or can I hang it up in my room? What are all the needs that I would have to provide? Well, the plant would have the needs, but what needs would this plant have that I would need to satisfy to succeed at keeping it?
Okay, I think first is choice. You know, you want to pick a plant that's going to be easy to adapt to your household conditions. So, you know, we make sure to tell people which ones are really good beginner varieties. There's a few Nepenthes, you know, coming to mind, like Nepenthes Diana, Nepenthes Bill Bailey, Nepenthes Briggsiana, Nepenthes Ventricosa. All these varieties have been selected because they're super vigorous. And they adapt really well to household conditions. So that's step number one. Step number two is you want to set yourself up for success in terms of where you grow it. You know, like I would choose, like I mentioned, these things are light lovers. So if you got a sunny window is going to be a great spot for most carnivorous plants, especially the beginner varieties. You want to make sure you're set up with the right soil. Usually something that doesn't have fertilizer added to it to begin with. There's a lot of really great resources out there. Steering people in the right direction about what soil mixes to use. Good quality water would probably be the next thing, you know, like if you've got RO water, distilled water, catch and rainwater, you've got runoff from your air conditioner, all those things work really well. You asked about ExoTerra tanks. There's a lot of plants that would do really well in tanks. But the trick is, you're going to want a pretty bright light over them. We actually do manufacture our own grow lights specifically because a lot of people had a lot of doubts over which grow lights they get. But, you know, with LEDs really widespread on the market now, like being the predominant light choice, they're just so efficient. You can usually find a pretty good light to grow at least the basic plants, you know, if just going to Lowe's or Home Depot.
I've had a lot of luck with the Fluval. It's actually an aquarium light. It's a freshened plant. It was an expensive light.
Oh, yeah,
those are great. Yeah, it was like, I think like a $200 light. And in my tanks that I have heavily planted, I've had really good growth with that. And it's lasted a long time. It's bright. I mean, let's just say that you didn't want to provide additional supplemental lighting, could you place one in a windowsill where it would get, say, I don't know, say like I have a southern exposure, so I have a spot in my house that might get a good, say, 8 hours of direct sunlight. Would you be able to keep it in? Because I'm just trying to think of like the ventilation, because like in certain places it's really, really dry. Like my house is really, really dry, so I'd be concerned about the ambient humidity and the plant not drying out. So that's why I'm kind of gravitating towards keeping it in a tank. Would that be something that would be possible?
Yeah, definitely. You know, you wouldn't want to, if you did that, you wouldn't want a completely sealed tank, at least for most varieties of carnivorous plants. Like we're talking to Nepenthes. You know, like you could have one that's got like a screen top to it, and it's gonna be fine. You know, with that humidity. But you know, I'll say a lot of the new cultivars out there, like some of those that I had mentioned, they're really adaptable to household humidity. You know, like the Mexican Pinguicula, also those ones can definitely take quite a bit of low humidity, as well as Sarracenia. You know, I've grown Sarracenia in some pretty arid places, and they do really well. You know, they don't really need a boost.
And what about the watering interests me, because you said RO and distilled water. You mentioned something before about salty water at places like in the big box hardware stores. When you see salty water, do you mean just water that hasn't been purified through RO, or do you mean water that's actually has something salty added to it?
Yeah. So it's not necessarily that it's got anything added to it. It's just, okay. So, I mean, it's all about total dissolved solids for them. And, you know, you can get into more details, you know, exactly what those solids are or everything, but, you know, just for the sake of argument, you know, it's just like, let's just say, you know, it's kind of an average number of solids, you know, coming down like from like rainwater. Rainwater is going to come in at about 6 parts per million. Right out of the sky, about 6 parts per million. It catches some stuff, you know, going through the atmosphere and all that. As the water runs through, you know, rivers, streams, you know, aquifers, all that stuff, it will pick up some minerals along the way. And so it will slowly get, a bit more TDS, total dissolved solids in it. You know, so like we're in the Austin area, and our water comes out from the aquifers around here, or, you know, or some of the lakes. And we've got a lot of limestone here. So our water is about 400 ppm. That's a bit too much for carnivores. They want something. Rule of thumb is about 100 ppm is about the most you want to continuously give them for them to thrive. You know, so for in a place like ours, you know, we would need to purify the water with reverse osmosis or some other method. But there's a lot of places in the country where you don't need to do that. Like, for example, the Pacific Northwest, a lot of California, where much of their water comes directly from snow runoff. I used to water out of the tap for years, and the plants did really well in those sort of places. So it's really easy to check your municipal water quality. You like whoever provides your water is, I believe there's a mandate that they have to publish what their recent water testing has been. And so, you know, it's a good resource to just go with there, go on the website and see kind of what your TDS usually is. And that will give you a good idea of, you know, what you have to do to treat your own water if you want to use that.
Yeah, the other reason I bring it up was I'd had a conversation with somebody about potting mixes and how certain commercial potting mixes are just a poor choice because of salt. And I think it was cocoa fiber was the substrate that came up. Something to the effect that cocoa fiber is just really, it retains a lot of salt. And what are your thoughts on cocoa fiber?
Okay, so I love coconut products. For a lot of carnivorous plants, it's better than peat in terms of sustainability. But the problem is most coconuts grow near the beach or near oceans. And so a lot of those coconuts and coconut products suck up a lot of salt. So generally when we get coconut chips, we actually have to go through a leaching process where we'll soak them in at least maybe 3 to 4 baths of a good quality water for like overnight before we can actually use the cocoa products. And there are some places where you can get inland coconuts, but that generally the ones that come into the US, those actually, most of the coconut product coming to the US are very salty. So I'm actually surprised that it's so widely used in the in terrariums, you know, for animals, because some animals can be sensitive to salts too. You know, especially amphibians that are, you know, that can pick up so much through their skin.
Yeah, I think that it's such an inexpensive, easily sourced material that somehow, some way, somewhere, someone developed a market for it. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's brown, it looks like dirt, it holds moisture really well, but I agree. As time has gone by, I just look less and less and less favorably upon it. And I think that most people are kind of doing that. I mean, certain things I'll keep on it, but for dart frogs, it's just a really, really poor choice for substrate. I mean, there have been times where I've used it to kind of like, I'll cut another substrate with a little bit of it just to stretch it. I mean, I wouldn't do that with the dart frogs, but for certain other animals that really aren't like high humidity, I've done it with. But I mean, I'm kind of on the fence because in a way it's a good way to make use of a resource because people are already harvesting coconuts. So why not use the product? But I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how that plays out in the next couple of years. If it just kind of completely disappears from the market because of stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. But, you know, again, like if you treat it properly, like the biggest carnivorous plant nursery in the world is located in Sri Lanka, or at least for Nepenthes, I'll say, the biggest Nepenthes nursery. And they use almost exclusively coconut products to grow all their plants. And, you know, it works great for them. But, you know, I think they care a lot in the quality control of the stuff coming in.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even begin to know the plant aspect of it, but you've got me thinking about long-term hydration for animals. And if the salt content is significant enough, I mean, do we have animals that it's somehow dehydrating? I don't know. Now I'm intrigued.
No, it certainly could be the case. You know, I've been doing dart frogs for, you know, almost as long as I've been doing carnivorous plants. And yeah, back in the day, we used to just get those bricks of cocoa fiber and just kind of throw them in water and put them in a tank, throw some pillow moss on it, and you know, it was good to go for the frogs, right? Like, maybe that really did have a long-term effect.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. And not other species as well. I'm wondering about inverts and species that don't... I mean, like, for example, like, animals like bearded dragons that don't necessarily drink from a dish, like a lot, like, like my bearded dragon, he just won't drink off of a dish. He won't drink off of misting either. So I just mist him really, really heavily just to get some hydration through respiration. And it's difficult keeping an animal hydrated that just doesn't actively drink like that. So now I'm intrigued. Now I'm wondering if the salt content in cocoa fiber is a factor in dehydration in animals. I don't know. Now you've piqued my interest. And if anybody out there has any insights, email me, cause I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. No, I'd be fascinated as well.
Yeah. Which species of frogs did you work with when you say dart frogs, which ones?
Oh, I mean, back when I started, they were all Dendrobates. Oh, I mean, I guess I had Phyllobates too. I've always had tinks and Terribilis are my favorites, some Ramitomea, Arautis, I still have a fairly large collection right now. You know, I've got probably too many frogs, probably about 50 or so. I really enjoy them. You know, it's kind of my hobby away from the plants.
Is there any possibility that you could construct a tank that would successfully be able to cohab a carnivorous plant and a frog, or is that not such a great idea?
I get asked this question a lot. So there are, I guess we'll get into it a little bit later. There are some frogs that use the plants exclusively for different parts of their life cycle. But, you know, in a tank, right? If we're talking, say, like Dendrobates, I think Nepenthes would make a great choice. In particular, Nepenthes ampullaria, like I mentioned before, this one that actually doesn't produce enzymes but kind of relies on water and bacterial action to break down its pitcher contents. Those ones I think would be very safe to put into a frog enclosure. In fact, you know, and I know you have got a lot of listeners over here who are, you know, Ufaga, Ufaga people. I would be fascinated if somebody could see if an Ufaga would raise its tadpoles in one of those ampullaria pitchers. They seem to be about the right size, like kind of similar to a bromeliad axis. I think that could be really successful. You know, I don't raise Ophaga. You know, life's pretty crazy right now. I know they're a little more sensitive than Dendrobates. But I think that would be an interesting experiment. And then some of the other carnivorous plant genera that might be successful in a terrarium, maybe some sundews or pinguicula if you put them in the right spot. But again, like a lot of these frogs are big enough where they're going to trample over them and maybe damage them. And then another one that's similar to Impenthes ampullaria is Sarracenia purpurea. And that one actually doesn't produce enzymes as well. It's got kind of these big traps that get kind of analogous to Nepenthes ampullaria. They get filled by rainwater, and it's actually bacteria action that break down the prey. So I would be, I'd be really intrigued as well if a dart frog would put its tadpoles in there, and if they would actually be reared. You know, I've actually seen tadpoles of other species of frogs in the wild being reared inside a I don't know about being reared, but they were just inhabiting Sarracenia purpurea pitchers.
Yeah, you know, let's get into that now. I mean, I have a lot more questions about the plants, but while we're on the frog topic, I mean, when you and I first started talking back in November, you'd sent me an email with some info about a species that you had seen in the wild, and you'd sent me two papers. Look at the first one here. This hit the Borneo bush frogs.
The Philauta species.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, my favorite thing in the world is to get out into the jungle. And, you know, I've seen the Nepenthes genus has about 150 species. I've seen about half of them in the wild so far. I was really fortunate, you know, in my 20s, I had a bunch of jobs that allowed me to travel a bit. You know, actually I was stationed in Southeast Asia for quite a bit. So on one of these trips, actually my first trip out, we were a group of all mainly Nepenthes enthusiasts. And there's this guy, his name is Chin Lee. And if you don't know Chin Lee, you should. This guy is incredible. He is he knows more about the rainforest of Southeast Asia than probably anybody. He is absolutely amazing. This guy, you know, this guy's hitting it big now. You know, he does assignments with David Attenborough and all that sort of thing. But you know, this guy's a Nepenthes expert, but he knows so much about everything out in the jungle. And so I was on a field trip with him. He took us up this mountain. It's called a Gunung Murud or Mount Murud. And we climb up there, and there's like five different Nepenthes species up there. So we're checking them out. And, it's a very mystical place. You know, there's this place up there called Church Camp, where essentially a lot of the local villages, they have like a church retreat that happens every year where they actually will hike like miles and miles into the jungle to this mystical, church retreat that's at the very top of the mountain. And you get up there and there's just Nepenthes species everywhere. It's like they're just growing like grass, all over the fields, all in the trees. And so we're hiking through there and, you know, through this magical place. And I start to see these frogs popping out of these pitchers. In particular, the species was Nepenthes. At the time, it was Nepenthes horeliana. It's been reclassified since then. It's Nepenthes mollis. So, and I'm seeing these frogs, and they're it's a little green bush frog. And I'm noticing they're not on the other pitchers. They're just in this one species. And so I'm trying to take pictures of the frog. On the Nepenthes, really, you know, and I just keep on noticing them, and they keep on retreating down deep into the fluid. So I think, that's kind of odd. So I go and tell Chin, who's leading the trip, about this, and he, you know, this guy is just infectious on how excited he gets, you know, about everything. He runs over to see where these frogs are hanging out. And I think he realizes, you know, like that this is something unique. He hasn't seen this before anywhere. And we start going through and, realizing that there's tadpoles in there too. And that's where it gets really interesting. I remember he was so excited. He just about, he just about bowled me over one time, you know, kind of like he was going to get the shot. And, you know, this guy, you know, his photography is amazing. But he, you know, he kind of like body checked me just to get through. And it was, I like to kid with him now. We found this, and, you know, like, I'm by far from a herpetologist. Chin knows a lot about that stuff, but he said, all right, I'm going to get some experts involved here. So he got in contact with some people, and, you know, they went back not too long after that, and they realized this was a different frog species than had ever been described. And not only that, like, all parts of the life cycle of this species exist solely on this Nepenthes species, Nepenthes mollis. You know, it's a really interesting adaptation for the tadpoles. They actually, they're endotrophic, meaning that they actually don't really eat much, like, while they're developing as tadpoles. What they do is actually, they've got a really big yolk sac to them. And, you know, whenever they're first laid, they actually don't even have much eye development. They're just kind of in the picture developing. And they get bigger. And then eventually, they'll morph out. You know, they've even evolved this kind of sucker mechanism that kind of allows them to kind of stay attached to the side of the pitcher. And you know, the thought is that there's a mutualism between the frog and the plant, that the plant gets the benefit of a lot of the excrement of the tadpole and the adult frogs. And the tadpole and the frog, they get protection, you know, in an environment and also a wet environment, because there's not a whole lot of places where you get pools of water up in that area.
That's incredible. I just pulled up a picture of the genus here. I'm trying to find a type species. So this was, you were literally in the middle of a scientific, well, multiple scientific discoveries, and this just happened right in front of you. That's, wow, that's incredible.
And it was my first trip to Borneo, you know, and, you know, so imagine inspiring, right? Like, where there's science happening, like, right in front of my eyes, right? And I just kind of stumbled into it.
It's amazing. There's so much out there that we haven't, everyone thinks that we've seen everything. No, we're not just, constantly be on the lookout. So basically, I mean, what we can say as of this point then is, obviously, any species of carnivorous plant that's not directly producing any sort of digestive enzyme would be a possible candidate for some sort, for some unknown species at this point, known or otherwise, to reproduce in. That's wild.
Yeah, I mean, there's all these cool mutualistic relationships. Like, on that same mountain, there's mammals. There's a tree shrew that it's got this relationship with this other Nepenthes species called Nepenthes loyi, where the Nepenthes loyi will actually put out this sugary type of yogurt. You call it exudate. It's on the lid of the plant, and the pitcher is actually shaped like a toilet. Well, these tree shrews, they're super nervous, super fast moving. They'll come back multiple times a day, and they'll lick the lid because they want the sugars. But then the pitcher has skid marks all over it. Whenever you go and you take a look at them, they're, you know, it really is a toilet. And so the plant itself is exchanging, sugar, which it gets for free from photosynthesis, for the nitrogen, that's in the excrement, that, you know, they can't get that.
Ah, the beauty of nature. In all its glory. But that's one of the things that people don't often understand, is that many species of tree frog that are tree hole breeders, the contents of some of these tree holes is just vile. It's just beyond gross, with all the nasty stuff that finds its way down in there. But that's an interesting relationship. I mean, obviously, I would, you know, before anybody starts putting anything in with their frogs, I would obviously encourage them to do as much research as possible. But That's a wild story. And there was one other paper that you sent me as well here. It was a different, I think you meant you weren't on this, but you sent it to me anyway. New species of microhyla from Sarawak. Smallest frogs out of miniature pitcher plant in Borneo.
Oh, yeah. So that's another one of these pitcher plant amphibian relationships. Microhyla nepenthicola. Those occur exclusively on some Nepenthes ampullaria populations in Sarawak. And this species is the smallest frog species in the old world, or at least at the time of publication it was. And again, it's it's one of these Nepenthes that doesn't produce enzymes. Nepenthes molus actually does, so that's even more impressive that the Phalaenopsis frogs can withstand that. But microhyla, they're in the Nepenthes ampullaria, and it's another one of these endotrophic tadpole stages where they're not actually really eating anything; they've just got a very large yolk sac that they kind of live off of as they morph. And they turn out to these, you know, little frogs that are about, you know, no more than a centimeter or so in size. Actually, they're a little bigger than a centimeter, I'll say. They're just, you know, they're just around the plants, and they just occur in a very limited region in Sarawak. That's Western Borneo.
Sarawak, I think it's known for some of its green tree python.
I think it's
a locale of green tree python's a whole other thing outside of the world, but that's its whole that's its whole niche rabbit hole disaster. But Borneo is wild. I mean, besides the pitcher plants and the frogs, what was there anything specific about Borneo that struck you while you were there?
I would say, you know, if you get a chance to go to Borneo, anybody out there, go. It's just incredible, you know, just so much biodiversity, everything, you know. I'm always struck by the insect diversity everywhere I go there. It's just, you know, there's all these insects. You know, I thought I knew a lot of insects. I know nothing, right? Like after going, you know, and I'll say that about plants and animals too. You go there and you realize how little you know. You find insects there that have, you know, you just have to look at them and you could probably dream up kind of why they're shaped or what purpose they serve in their environment. And, you know, it could be something that you never even thought of. You know, it's just amazing. The insects, there's a bunch of really cool reptiles there you see. And the plant life is just incredible. So diverse.
What's interesting about Southeast Asia is, and again, I could be wrong in saying this, but the poison frogs in Central and South America, we've got Mantella in Madagascar, which is a kind of a convergent evolution. I don't know of anything like that in Southeast Asia, and I'm surprised given the biodiversity and the climate in Southeast Asia. I mean, I don't know. I'd be interested to see if there was some sort of convergent evolution down there as well, because it seems like something should be there.
I'm surprised too, but there are so many parts that is just not explored that, you know, maybe it's just a matter of time till we find something that has that same relationship, you know, with that with batrachotoxin or something like that.
It would be interesting. That would probably be like the biggest amphibian discovery of the century.
There's some cool stuff there for sure, right? You know, it's like a Chin, this guy, you know, I was talking about, who I go on all the jungle treks with. He rediscovered a location for rainbow toads. Those were thought to be extinct.
Really?
And that was just like, that was like within like 45 minutes of his house, I guess. You know, he got a lead, went out there. You know, he had actually invited me to go, and I'm kicking myself. I still kick myself for not going. He rediscovered them.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, so much of my content is Central and South America because the dendrobatids just sort of by default. I mean, to be honest, when I started this show, I didn't really have the intention of focusing on dendrobatids. It just sort of came that way because there was a lot of scientific research and a lot of hobbyists, and there was just more of a hunger for that type of information. And then that's just kind of where I ended up. But I've had so few people on with observations from other places like Southeast Asia and really Asia in general. I mean, I've had people from pretty much every continent, I think, except Asia. So the Southeast Asian amphibians, that interests me, because for me, that's kind of an untapped resource that I'm really fascinated about and learning some more about species.
There's just so much diversity there. So much diversity. You know, let me tell you what's on my bucket list. You know, I haven't done it yet, but, you know, I got a bunch of buddies that have done this. There's actually a competition every year in Kuching. That's Western Sarawak. And it's called, let's see, it's the Great Bornean Amphibian Relay. Let me think about this real quick. International Bornean Frog Race. That's what it is. International Bornean Frog Race. So this gets all the it attracts a lot of herpetologists from around Southeast Asia, and the whole thing that they do is they get together in Kuching or some designated national park, and it's a race. It's how many amphibian species can you you observe and photograph within 24 hours. And there's people that go hardcore to this, man. They'll spot for like weeks beforehand, just, you know, to try to get the specific locations where they can go, or they're most likely to find one species. And you know, they take it seriously, and there's a prize at the end, man. So I can think of nothing better. You know, that combines some of my favorite things, like trekking in Malaysia, amphibians. You know, getting out there, getting dirty, photography. It just sounds wild to me.
What's the prize?
You know, I think there's a cash prize for it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was saying,
but you know, don't quote me on that. I think I've heard that before, but I'm not sure. Whatever it is, man, I do that for free all day long.
I just think that, yeah, the awesome prize would be like, okay, we're going to give you airline tickets and a hotel to stay in when you come next year. That'd be a pretty good prize. I feel like that'd be an addictive race. Is there anywhere else in Southeast Asia that you'd like to visit? Because I mean, there's so many places that I would love to just go to down there. Like I've always been interested in Java and some of the islands, other islands in Indonesia.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So I've been through a lot of Indonesia. Java's got some cool stuff, but Java's actually pretty populated. So some of the stuff there is, you know, like kind of more confined to like reserves and all that. But what I find fascinating about Indonesia is it's right in the middle of this. Are you familiar with the Wallace Line?
No.
Okay. So Wallace, very famous, biologist, and he was actually one of the people that kind of kicked Darwin in the rear to publish the theory of evolution, because if not, he was going to do it. So Wallace, he first explored South America. Actually, maybe I'm getting this backwards, but I think it was he first explored South America, and then he wasn't wealthy like Darwin was. So he actually had to take a lot of the things that he collected and go back to England and sell it. Well, he was in a his boat went down, so like all of the collecting that he had done on his first trip, it went down into the ocean. So he was set on another course, and I believe this one was Southeast Asia, and maybe I'm getting this wrong, maybe it was Southeast Asia that went down, but either way, like whenever he was out in Southeast Asia, he realized there was kind of a line where everything on one side was much more like Australia flora and fauna, east of the line, and everything west of the line was more similar to Asia. So that actually has its beginnings in kind of intercontinental tectonic plates. You know, kind of it's the Sulu Shelf and the Sunda Shelf, I believe. And so you get to the east of the line. So I've been to Papua before, And, you know, there's amazing wildlife in Papua. The birds of paradise are just amazing over there. You know, like nothing you could ever dream of. And, but over on that side of the line, you know, it's much more deadly. I'll say that, you know, like you start having to really worry about a lot of venomous snakes and other things. Like when you're trekking through, you know, there's not really many big mammals on that side. It's more birds, actually. Those are the predominant, like large predators. And then you move over west, and as soon as the Wallace line is kind of somewhere, you know, around, those islands that are kind of between like Papua and Bali, kind of like, there's like Halmahera, some other places there. So west of the line, that's where you get, where you got a lot of species that have, are a lot more similarities with from mainland Asia. So you start to get mammals like tigers and, you know, you start to get a lot of, cobras, things like that. You know, in the wild, or the fauna, it also kind of mirrors that as well.
Yeah. I'm thinking
of the flora mirrors that as well, but also the fauna.
I'm thinking of the tree kangaroo. Now that you mentioned, I know what you're talking about. Oh, yeah. I'm thinking about the, like, yep. You've got this species of arboreal kangaroo in Indonesia, mm-hmm. and like, well, why aren't there monkeys there? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. So you get a lot of convergent evolution over there. But you know, I would love to visit Sulawesi. This is why I say, you know, or you asked me where next place I'd like to visit in Southeast Asia. Well, I've never been to Sulawesi, but Sulawesi, it runs right in the middle of the line. So you get a mix of both things that came over from, you know, kind of more Australian, evolution and stuff from Asian evolution, and you kind of, it all mashes up there.
That's incredible. You think about biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
Like what interested me was, I mean, I live on an island, so maybe I'm biased, but I'm fascinated by island species. Things like insular dwarfism and mm-hmm. just this. The islands are their own unique little biodiversity spots, and just Indonesia is just this, so many islands coupled together in places like Java. Like what you mentioned before about it being really urban. Yeah, you're right. I was thinking about this one preserve. I think it's all the way on the west. I could be wrong. I think it's on the very west end of Java. And that's where I think like the last Javan rhinoceros is. And to be able to see something like that would like, for me, that would be like a bucket list thing. I know they're probably gone, but like to see if I saw a Javan tiger and a Javan rhinoceros, I could die a happy man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That would be incredible, man. There are still some places that are pretty wild. You know, and a lot of the places that you find that are the most wild are the ones that, are a little less hospitable, for people to live or travel in, you know, so you got to get off the beaten path, but you can see some pretty amazing stuff still.
I can't even begin to imagine. Well, I mean, when it comes back to the plants, we talked about beginners, but we really didn't talk about beginner mistakes. Where could people go wrong when working with carnivorous plants? What are some common mistakes that people just getting started might make that they want to avoid?
Yeah. So, I think, some people, you know, it even goes back to like a lot of the old textbooks that used to talk about carnivorous plants. They'd say carnivorous plants need absolute 100% humidity at all times or they'll die. A lot of beginners will take that to heart. They'll put them in a sealed terrarium or something like that. And, they're still plants. They want some airflow. You know, if you put them in there, it's also gonna, in with a strong light, it's also gonna cook them. So I think I see that problem a lot. You know, like people will get a fly trap, they'll get a 10-gallon terrarium, they'll put that the fish tank lid on it, they'll put a bright light on it, and it's going to be like over 100 degrees in there. You know, and so that is one mistake. I mentioned the water thing. That can definitely be a mistake. You know, other things, light. A lot of times the plants will just not look right if you're not giving them the correct amount of light. They'll look kind of leggy. A lot of times an Nepenthes won't even picture if it's not getting enough light. Like a sundew, they won't even put dew out of their leaves. Yeah, I think, and you mentioned earlier, like some of these commercial garden soils, a lot of beginners will kind of think that that's their best soil. You know, it's like, oh, I'm getting the creme de la creme stuff with fertilizer and all that. Actually, they don't want that. They, you know, if you're going to get like, you know, soil from like a big box store or something, you want to go for like the more pure ingredients, you know, like pure sphagnum moss or pure peat, or the perlite that doesn't have anything mixed in it.
So it's safe to say then you probably shouldn't buy a Venus flytrap that you see at the hardware store, right? In the death box.
Yeah, I would say if you want to set yourself up for success, go to a reputable nursery that, you know, that they know how to grow them and they'll give you the information to do it. And that's probably how you're going to set yourself up the best. You know, once you get the hang of it, you could probably take those and rehab them. And, you know, it could be a good deal. Sometimes I'll notice those things, they'll be marked off to like $3 when they're like knocking off desk or necking on desk door. You know, they'll be marked way down. And, well, you know, you could take those, grow them right, put them in like a big bowl and just have like a, you know, a mess of fly traps on your front porch or something.
Do the fly traps need a dormancy period at all? Because I, from what I understand in South Carolina, there's some weather changes that you don't have in other parts of the world. Is that a factor at all?
Yeah. Okay. So this is heavily debated. And I generally try to respect their dormancy, especially if you want flowers, you're going to mess up their cycle. But I know a lot of really good growers who give fly traps no dormancy at all and a constant photo period, and they do well for years. So, I'll say it's not absolutely required, but if you can give it to them, I do think you know that will help them keep a steady cycle.
Interesting. So I have another question here. So, buddy of mine, he's got Zach Port. He's got a greenhouse out in Utah, which is absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And one of the plants that he got is, I'm going to try and pronounce the genus names, Platycerium.
Oh yeah. Okay. Love those.
Yeah. Tell us about that, because I, when I was had him on, I was trying to reference the plant and I couldn't remember what it was called. And then I saw it later. You carry those on your site. Can you tell us about them?
Oh yeah. So, those are, Platycerium. A lot of people will call them elephant ear ferns. And those are really cool because they grow as epiphytes. And one of their adaptations is they'll actually create, they call it a shield frond, which some of their early leaves, they'll actually wrap around a tree to try to make, they're actually trying to trap soil and leaf litter and that sort of stuff onto themselves, because it's going to break down. It's going to provide them nutrition later on, and also a place where they can get more constant moisture. So after they go through this phase where they kind of wrap themselves around the tree to try to, you know, build up this detritus, that's where they start putting out their longer leaves, and they can get pretty big depending on the species. I've seen some that, you know, where they were way bigger than a person, you know, like especially some of those species in Papua. So in terms of growing them, I think they're best displayed if you mount them to something. You know, a lot of people will kind of wrap the roots in like sphagnum moss, or like an orchid mix. And then they'll mount them to like a piece of wood. And then, you know, you can fertilize them by just dropping in like an extended release fertilizer into that, shield area, that I mentioned that they use to try to kind of make a little bit of a pot, if you will, of a material, above them and around the root system. There's been a recent development, that I'm super excited about. See, like a lot of the staghorns that we like to carry are actually a miniature variety. That would be perfect for like a tank or like a grow tent, something like that. Some of them get no bigger than maybe like a foot across. Some of them have really wild shapes. Like there's like these new varieties like Platycerium Jade Girl and Bacteria. And there's one that's called Oh My God, Omen G. All these ones are, they're really cool, but like, they're still accessible for people who don't have a lot of space. Cause like traditionally, like a lot of these big species like Platycerium wandii or those ones, they get humongous, you know, like really you kind of have to have a greenhouse or like if you live somewhere like Florida, you can kind of grow them outside year round.
Yeah, it's such a strange looking plant. When I feel like I'd seen them before in passing, but when I stopped and I actually looked at it, I was like, wow, this thing is wild. What's the benefit of having that? I don't know if you mentioned the term for it earlier, but I guess the dark brown spot, that's like leaves that have kind of hardened and made a shell, right?
Yeah. Well, they're trying to catch one more broken down leaf litter, that sort of stuff. And that naturally is just going to provide more roots as that stuff slowly decays. It's going to provide more nutrition for their roots. So it's catching that. It's also catching, and when that breaks down, it's going to create kind of more wet stuff, because planetariums, this is generally true for a lot of planetariums. They live in these places where it's not wet all the time. There's definitely some dry parts of the season, or at least, like some time in between rains, and they want to be able to keep some moisture in that root zone. So that's the perfect way to do it, kind of catch your own soil, create your own soil whenever you're living up in a tree. And so one thing that I've noticed is, I was all over Papua, and I noticed the two plants that live in the same ecological niches as Nepenthes, which is like up on trees, are one, ant plants, which have really cool mutual relationships with ants that actually live inside the plant, and then the planetariums. So both of those live in places in Papua that are a similar ecological niche, but Papua has more dry seasons than other places like Borneo, like other places in Southeast Asia. So, the Nepenthes, it's not quite wet enough for the Nepenthes, but it is wet enough to sustain like the ant plants and the platycerians.
That's wild. It's such a bizarre looking plant. So, silly question, which I have to ask. Does anybody come over your greenhouse and ask you if you have an Audrey too?
Constantly. I we don't have anything that big yet. I do have one. We had our first truly viral Instagram video not too long ago. So we had this. It was a leopard frog that was living in our greenhouse, and this thing lived for years. And I was surprised because we don't spray that many insecticides. We usually try to use beneficials as opposed to insecticides, like beneficial insects. They actually work even better than pesticides for most things. But this thing just kept on surviving. It was an old frog, and so eventually it did die, so we're like, well, this thing's dead, let's see what we can do with digesting it. So we fed it to one of our big pitcher plants, and then we documented it over time. And man, that thing, I think everyone can check out the video. That thing got digested, all but the bones. It took about 2 months.
You heard it here, folks. You heard it here first, folks. That's something. Did you leave the legs hanging out as a warning to other frogs? Like, don't do this. I'm just picturing this big fat leopard frog, like ragdolled with its legs hanging out.
The picture was just big enough where the whole thing got shoved down.
That's amazing. Yeah. I'm sure that probably gets really annoying after a while. That and, what are some, let's just, I mean, everybody,
yeah,
people have questions, of course, and a lot of times people are, they just don't know any better, and it's not to be malicious, but I'm sure that there's a lot of stupid questions they could ask. What are some of the more, we'll just say irritating questions that people ask over and over again?
There's repeated questions. I'll go there, but I think it's cool that people are engaged and at least know enough about this stuff in popular culture that, they have some idea, about it. Right. I think that part's actually pretty cool. Even if everybody thinks they're making the joke for the first time, and, I've heard it 10,000 times. The stuff from Little Shop of Horrors. Let's see. There's a lot of people that kind of spread the myth that the plants are so hard to grow, and you know, they kind of dissuade people. You know, say like, because we used to do a lot of reptile shows, and you know, you'd get the odd person who'd go around, and we'd be talking with the customer, trying to figure out where the best place to grow these plants would be in their house. And then somebody would tap them on the shoulder, you know, just kind of tell them, no, don't do this. You know, like, it's all going to die on you. You know, that did get a little old, you know, because, you know, truthfully, like there's a lot of carnivorous plants, you know, especially now with the modern breeding, that can really grow well in people's houses, you know? So I just think that that's bad information.
I think maybe the failures that people experience with store-bought stuff without, not store-bought, but, you know, big box hardware store places without any real information, or, I mean, again, I feel like situations like that, just with anything, with any living thing, if you don't provide someone with enough information, you set the person up to not succeed. And then I think that can leave a sour taste in someone's mouth.
Yeah, definitely. You know, especially cause you know, there's a lot of animal keepers that really do awesome things, you know, like they keep hard to keep, you know, species, you know, and breed them and all that stuff, you know, and if they get set up for failure, you know, they're going to remember that.
Yeah. And it's also a matter, I think, people just understanding that plants do have needs, that you can't just necessarily stick every plant in a corner and just completely ignore it and expect it to do well. Like I'm the only person in my house with a green thumb. So I try not to let anybody touch my plants. And I actually had, now that I look at your site, I don't know if I could identify the exact species, but I had one of the Sarracenias at one point, and for the life, I don't remember where I got it, but for the life of me, I don't quite remember which variety it was. It might have been this one, White Wizard, maybe. It wasn't colored particularly dramatically, but anyway, before this becomes really boring, I had entrusted someone in my family to care for it for a week, and I came back and it was dead. And I was like, that's like
those ones don't like to dry out.
Yeah, I was like, that's I mean, like, it was only a week, please. But again, I could see that leaving people with the idea that they're really difficult to care for. And it's not that they're difficult. It's just that you have to figure out what they need and provide it consistently.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunity there, because I know a lot of people are getting really sophisticated in their vivarium setups. You know, with automated misting and RO systems and all that stuff, you know, those are a lot of the things that these plants want. And if you set that up, you know, just to provide a little bit of moisture to them, you know, in some type of consistent way, like, they're just going to thrive.
And what about different ways of getting plants? Because, I mean, I'm on your website. I don't know the different ways that you sell plants, but seeds, cuttings, an established plant, what are the pros and cons of each?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, established plants, you know, the benefit is you get something that's solid, you know, to begin with, you know, something that's already growing well. And, you know, it's kind of like, I look at it kind of like a train, you know, like something that's well started. You know, it takes a lot to take a train off the tracks. You know, it can happen, but, it's got this momentum going, you know, forward, that it's, you know, it's well started. Whereas like a seedling or a freshly established cutting, something like that, it doesn't quite have that momentum going for it. So it's a little bit easier to get knocked off. You know, so like seedlings generally require very similar care to an adult plant. It's just like any other immature, you know, organism. It's a pretty tender stage, as you're growing it. So a lot of times, there's a lot more room for error. We do a lot of our own propagation, and actually we do a lot of work with tissue culture, that's actually growing plants in a sterile environment. That's essentially like you put them in a sterile environment, and it's Jell-O that has fertilizer in it and a little bit of sugar, and you know, that the plants, they take off. Carnivorous plants, you know, most genera, you can figure out a formula to really get them to grow quickly. And then, you know, they come out of there, and it's like, you know, you just hit them with, you know, I don't, how's a way to describe it? You know, you just gut loaded them, whatever, right? You know, they're full of nutrients. They're growing. They're strong. And so you plant those out into the greenhouse. And as long as you properly acclimate them to the greenhouse, those plants, they've really, they're growing fast. They're hitting their stride and they've got a lot of nutrient reserves. So like they can take some punishment.
So Drew, this has all been really interesting and really insightful. And, I mean, I'm looking at your website and we're kind of at the end here, but I wanted you to just tell the listeners how they could find out more about what you sell, how they can get it from you, how they could find out more information. And anybody who's interested, who's listening, who might want to get a deeper dive, how could they find out more and buy from you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first place you could stop by is our website. We're at carnivoro.com. We actually do quite a bit on social media as well. We post a lot of content and information. We've got an Instagram. We've got a YouTube channel, which we're going to be working on a lot this year. You know, on Facebook as well. Also, we do these live sales every week or a couple times a week through a couple different apps. So Instagram and Plant Story is an app that just came out it's actually just for live shows of plants. And, you know, my favorite thing there is really just connecting with people. Especially people new to the carnivorous plant hobby and really helping them choose the right plants along the way, you know, and it's a good time for discussion. So, yeah, I mean, anybody who's interested, just go ahead and check us out on any of those sources or send us an email, love to hear from you.
Absolutely. And you've got a great, I'm going to include a link to the website in the show notes because you've got these plants are just beautiful. I mean, I'm just looking at the Nepenthes, and some of these are just, I mean, they kind of remind me of like the Kool-Aid man, because they're so big and rare. And that's probably a terrible example, but.
No, not at all.
the Diana is just so vividly red, and it's just, they're just such cool looking plants. And the Nepenthes, the ones here in the U.S. are pretty cool, but these are just like another level. And they're reasonably inexpensive too. I was expecting everything to be like in the thousands of dollars, and you've got stuff here for, you know, like very reasonable prices.
Yeah. That's the goal though, is the goal is to, drive the prices down, make something that's easy to grow for people. And that takes pressure off of any poaching in the wild, you know, because it makes no sense for people to be ripping these things out of the dirt and sending them in a box from Malaysia if you can buy something that's even better for like 15, 20 bucks, already, you know, sustainably produced in the U.S.
That's another good point. I mean, I've always been a big fan of this whole thing with, and at this point, in the 21st century, we've kind of established many of these things to the point where we're not necessarily relying on having to pull things out of the wild anymore. And
yeah,
I give a lot of credit to people who work with frogs, but also to people like you. I mean, I guess I kind of underestimated the fact that a lot of these plants are probably taken from spots where they shouldn't be, and to have a sustainable captive population here in the States is probably a very good thing.
Yeah, no, that's one of our goals.
Yeah. Well, Drew, again, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking to me. This is, I love going down rabbit holes like this, and this is just so interesting. I've learned so much. So I want to thank you for taking the time to come on and talk to me. And and again, I want to thank all of you for listening. It's been a really insightful episode. I like doing plant content, and I want to give a big shout out to Drew for coming on and talking to me about a unique set of plants that I did not know anything about. And now I know more, and now I'm intrigued. Now I think I might have to get some soon. So
thanks for having me, Dan. It's been great. It's a lot of fun.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Drew. All right, everyone. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I did too. Lots of fun. Great topic. Pitcher plants. My new favorite plant. So, yeah. All kidding aside, though, again, thanks everybody for your support. Moving forward, we've got a lot of cool stuff coming up. So make sure you stay tuned, and I'll catch up with you again next time.